Accession number 19013, reel 3.
This is Bob Rose, reel 3. Right, you're in this wood. Is it near the Orne Canal?
Yes, that's right. And about maybe 4 or 5 miles from the coast, with the Navy acting as artillery, firing over the top of us all night. And
how do you make contact with the enemy at this time?
Only snipers who had been left behind. There was one in particular. I remember someone said there was a sniper in a church tower. Someone else said, they'd seen someone go in a Cossack, black Cossack, and this sort of thing.
But had you a job to do? Did you have to hold the canal bridge or something?
No, we had to get back. Uh-huh. Our main aim was to get back to the breachhead.
But your lads you carried at the back, were they staying behind to fight?
Oh, yeah, they were gone.
They'd gone?
They'd gone, oh, yes.
What were you armed with?
I had a normal Lee Enfield rifle. That was my full kit, I think, as far as that concerned. We were issued with commando knives, I remember, which were the modern weapon in those days. They thought they would be suitable for glider pilots. And, of course, we did have the commando knife.
So your job, you were purely bus drivers?
We were bus drivers on this occasion, because the idea was to get back to the beachhead as quickly as possible. We couldn't move at night because there's all this bombing going on over the top of us and shelling. And, of course, at daybreak, we got the order to move again. Going back to this particular sniper in the church tower, one of those dramatic moments where you get an artillery officer comes up, what's the hold up? And here we were on a crossroads, and nobody ready to run across, you see, because of the sniper's activities. And he said, we got a sniper up in the church tower. So, of course, he had a very large walkie-talkie, and he spoke to someone. And the next minute, a 25-pounder turned up, and, of course, he took the top of the tower off. So, of course, we first shot, brilliant, just laid it up. I always say it was a 25-pounder, and I'm never quite sure. I knew a 6-pounder, and we trained on a 25-pounder with the artillery. We used to go down there, and we used to do every number on the gun except laying. So we were good at carrying ammunition, we were good at loading, we were good at unloading, but we didn't do any laying. They didn't have time to teach us laying, so that was it. Anyway, we eventually got to the beachhead.
And presumably all the ground had been taken that you crossed.
Oh, that's right, yeah. And, of course, there was traffic in both directions with jeeps with stretchers on and ambulances and all the rest of it. And of course, when we got the beachhead was strewn with stretchers as far as you could see, probably 3 deep. And there was civilians, there was British, there was French, there was Germans, all laid out in long lines, you see.
Injured?
All wounded. And of course, to greater or lesser degrees and so on. And of course the beachmaster said, oh, you glider pilots, he said, put your kit down, he said, I want this beach clearing, and I'll tell you when your landing craft is coming in. He said it's L-22 or whatever. So we put our kit down, and there we were loading these wounded onto landing craft as they were coming in. And, of course, that was about the most uncomfortable job of D-Day, was wading sort of chest high into the sea to load these wounded and on the stretchers into the landing craft. And, of course, we'd made quite an inroad onto it to clear the beach. And he said, right, here's yours coming in. And, of course, we had to get our kit and then wade out and get on board, and we started our way back. And
were you attacked by the Luftwaffe at this time?
Yes, we were. I can always remember three came in, and the Navy just opened up with Beaufort, and I'd never seen anything like it. The three just disintegrated in front of us. You know, it was. That was as much as we saw the Luftwaffe. It didn't exist after that for quite a long time, I understand.
Now, you were all soaked to the skin, weren't you?
Soaked to the skin, hungry. And I thought I'd met the finest thing that science had ever invented, and that was... I don't know whether it's ever caught on. I know that some people have tried it since, but it's too expensive. That was a tin of soup, and you pull the top off, there was a wick, you lit that with a cigarette or similar, and waited for 5 minutes or so whilst it burnt away, and you poured it out and you had a tin of hot soup. And I thought that was, you know, high tech. Wonderful. I never saw them again afterwards. But this landing craft was loaded with food. And, of course, I remember... Because it was a very large landing craft.
Landing ship, was it?
That's right. Yeah. And, of course, it had had lorries on and one thing and another. And every transport. And the commander said, "Under that tarpaulin, lads, all the food you want. Get on with it." Never seen anything like it. I had a great liking in those days for Bartley pears. I still do. But I'd never eaten a 7-pound tin before. But that's what we were treated to. Got back to New Haven about, late evening, I suppose, and taken to a barracks quite close to there, where we were completely kitted out again.
You had a chance for a shower and everything.
Showers, and they had all this, and we were the first customers for this facility, you see. And we were taken in, all our old uniform, you're given a plastic bag, all your personal belongings went in. You just dropped out of your old uniform. You went through and you picked up a new uniform and all the rest of it, you see. And the amazing part about it is you would pick them up with sergeant and staff sergeant stripes on. So it wasn't a question of getting them to fit. It was a question also of getting one that suited your rank as well.
Did you have the right regimental clashes?
No, we didn't at that stage, but we at least they give us the rank. You see. Yeah. Anyway, we... I suppose we were released from there about midday, and a fleet of lorries came up to take us back to Fargo camp on the plane, which was our headquarters.
This is about June the 8th.
For debriefing, And I remember going into the Grand Hotel. And we went into the foyer and went through to the bar.
Where is this?
In Brighton,
right.
On the way through. And we were looking fairly clean and smart and all the rest of it, you see. And I remember somebody saying, "Have you blokes seen the news, you see?" And one of our wags says, "We don't read it. We only make it." You know, this sort of thing. Anyway, got back to Fargo and debriefing, and then back to Kiel. And they said, "Things are going well, lads. No need for another glider." And I think they shipped us off to watch it in Somerset, where somebody'd stuck some tents up. And it was a sort of rest camp for us, you see, where we could recover from all these traumas we'd been through. We'd had a wonderful time, really. But there we are. So, and then, of course, it was back then, spot of leave. and then back into training again. And I got back to the regiment after leave and was immediately sent on my continuation course, which we regarded as our first pilot's course, you see. And this, of course, is where I met Sigs Hockley. The first few flights I'd done with an instructor, and he said, okay, well, you're ready to go solo. Going solo didn't really mean that. You always had another bod in the other seat, you see. And
it's this, still on a hawser, is it?
Yeah. Mm. And this turned out to be Sigs Hockley. And, of course, he'd been used as a guinea pig there for quite a while. And then he said, oh, I see on orders that you and I have got a team up. So I said, oh. I said, have you been posted to D squadron? And so he said, yeah. So I did all my, it's only a fortnight's course, the continuation course, with probably about 3 hours night flying, this sort of thing. And we came back to Kiewel together. And of course, that was it. We were teamed up and it worked very well. All my flights after that were with Sigs. And at the last moment, this is rather strange. We were expecting to go. We were briefed, bear in mind, for about 10 or 12, maybe, operations from coming back from flying school up to Arnhem in the September. And each of these operations, in fact, on one occasion, we loaded up with the SAS. And their jeeps were so heavy that we could only get the one in. They had multiple Vickers guns and all this, that, the other, two Brens and a Vickers pointing forward and quite weighty. And anyway, we managed to send to one of these, and yeah, that'll be all right, we'll manage with that, and balance it off, and got the thing loaded up, and we were to land on Orly Airport, and they were to do a very quick raid on the telecom centre and the radio station. We were not to be involved. We had keep out of it. There wasn't room on the jeep anyway, you see. So of course our job was flyman, and that was cancelled within about 2 hours of takeoff. And what had happened was the ground forces had moved so well, they'd taken the airport, so rather than trust us, the glider pilot regiment, with these guys, they threw them in Dakotas, you see, because the Dakota would more or less set the same load as the glider would. So they were flown in by Dakota, and so we didn't get that job.
So they still had to take that radio out, the SAS?
That was their objective, yeah. Mm. And successful, apparently. Mm. But of course, that put another operation off for us, so we were.
So you were in the intervening days, you were training all the time?
Training all the time and then being briefed for different operations, and none of which came to any fruition at all until Arnhem, of course. And I was second lift, went in on the Monday lunchtime, I think it was. But meanwhile, they'd moved us all of a hurry, within about 4 or 5 days, from Kiewel, just our flight, five flight. It's documented in this book. I don't know if you've ever seen it or not. Mm-hmm. It's written by a Dutchman.
Yeah.
And the...
Yeah, Bill's got one of these.
The research is fantastic.
Yeah.
But you could see, I think this page here deals with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And of course, we were pushed up to Blakehill Farm near Cirencester. And
that's an aerodrome, wasn't it?
Aerodrome, yeah. It. Yes, I don't think we'd been there many days. before takeoff.
Yeah.
And we met the load and the personnel with the load, which was a Jeep and an anti-tank gun. It's the second air landing brigade unit.
Was that a six-pounder anti-tank?
Six-pounder, yeah. Anyway, we just had time to have a chat about it. I said, what about unloading? Because we hadn't time to practice it. Oh, yes, we'd done a lot of that, Sarge. We know exactly what's what and so on. And just asking a few questions and satisfying myself that they did. And then, of course, it came to loading, and they obviously knew that they'd done it before we got it in, got it loaded. I never thought anything at all about it. As I said, socially, we never had a chance to get together because their barracks would always be separate to ours, you see, and this sort of thing. Ours were sort of RAF barracks, really, and they would probably be in tents on the perimeter kind of thing. So we never got to know one another socially. But when we took off, we had an extremely good flight, I thought. We saw one or two go down, mainly with broken tow ropes and this sort of thing. And when we came in over the landing zone, there was a bit of flak about and small arms fire. And, of course, we were doing a turn to port and a landing which was virtually south to north. And there was so much congestion, it was unbelievable. You know, you were trying to pick a spot. And there was a tendency to always go to port of the man in front of you, you see, if you were flying anywhere near his speed. And I was more or less over on the left-hand edge of the landing zone going in. And I always said it was the best landing I ever made. There was a gully to my left. And I don't think I've mentioned it before. When you're on the deck, you've got the advantage then that the wheels, the main wheels, have got differential brakes on, operated by the rudder bar. You see, as your speed falls off your rudder bar, the rudder becomes less effective. But of course, as your speed falls off, the braking on the wheels offsets that. So you can steer, so long as you've got forward motion. But this gully tended to take me down, and it was probably a good move on somebody's part, certainly not mine. But somebody was looking after us. And we found ourselves below the level of any small arms fire. You see, we're in this more or less gully. So I give the order to unload. And all of us are like, imagine this, both turning around together. I go up the port side, he goes up the starboard side, undoing the shackles on the gun. Now you've got two people from the back end coming forward and undoing the shackles on the Jeep. And then of course you've got your three men who are removing the tail. And the first you know about the tail is the daylight suddenly comes through as it's thrown off. And then you hear the scraping of the channels which go in and they go into section. And we got the shout from the rear end, all clear the centre, all clear at the front, all clear at the rear, all clear at the front. Right. Where you go, driver? The driver went, and he went about 4 or 5 feet and came to an abrupt halt. Nobody could figure out why. He said, she's stuck somewhere. So we started up around frantically. Now, I've already described that this hawser is an 8-foot diameter tube with the main spar of the wing coming across the centre and leaving a gap underneath underneath of the main spar to the floor through which the gun has got to go. for some reason this gun would not go. And I said that I had the tallest 6-pounder gun in the British Army. Sigs started with a fire axe chopping away at the wood to try and get it to go under. We were putting weight on. I had an entrenching tool stuck in the shield of the gun. It was the shield of the gun which was not going under the spar. And I was trying to lever it down. And it was almost as if someone had waved a baton, because about 4 or 5 voices shouted the same thing: let the bloody tyres down. So Siggs was the nearest, and he nipped out, undid the valve and started to let the tyres down, and I'm pulling, and we had the driver, and immediately it went underneath and out. And I spoke to the bombardier afterwards, before, because they were going to drive off again and leave. We had to rendezvous at the Artenstein, and they had to get and they had to get to the bridge. So we said our cheerios to them, but before he went, I said, what happened to our gun? He said, we were on the plane on exercise last week, he said, and we rolled it over. He said, but we put it back on its feet again and itched it up, and it seemed to be all right. I said, so you didn't report it? Cheerio, and away they went, you see. And they dislodged the shield of the gun, you know, the metal armour plate shield. And that is held on by U-boats. I've had a look at one since and satisfied myself as to what had happened. And they'd roll this over on the rough ground on the plane. And nobody, and of course, I eventually am wounded and taken prisoner of war, so there's no way of me doing a debriefing on this gun to warn people what was possible, you see. So, you know, if so I've always been able to say I had the tallest 6-pounder gun in the British Army. Don't know whether that was true or not.
Now, whereabouts did you actually land?
We landed at a place called Wolf Hazy, and to the left of that, I believe it's called, it's between Wolf Hazy and Ginkle Heath. Ginkle Heath was the area where the Paras landed mainly. There's a picture somewhere.
Was that far out of town? Well, we can look at it later.
Must have been 8 or 9 kilometres from the bridge, which, you know, the Arnhem Bridge. And of course, we started off, we went to the Artenstein, and a bit hazy here, I don't know who was giving the orders, but we finished up following the road into Arnhem, and
we're on foot.
And there was a group of us, probably 8 or 9 of us, you see.
Was there much resistance at this point?
Very little. Yeah. There was dead all around us, because we're the second lift, you see, first lift. And there's one or two, and we ran into that awful situation where these people out of the mental home, it's well documented, were greeting us and all this, that and the other. And of course, when I suppose we must have been about 3 kilometres, we're well in the urban area, and about 3 kilometres from the bridge, and there was a 6-pounder gun at the end of the street with its nose pointing to the left at crossroads. And as we were coming towards it, there was a sudden explosion, and this thing was going backwards across. It hit by a Tiger tank, you see. So everybody jumped in the jeep. Everybody. Never seen so many blokes on one jeep in my life. And we heard it back along the from whence we came. And we finished up in the village of Oosterbeek. Meanwhile, one of our group, Johnny Howe, he was a glider pilot, and he was hit by a sniper out of a bungalow as we were going past, through the shoulder blade and chest and all the rest of it. And anyway, he was dispatched with a grenade. Somebody crept up and threw a grenade in and all the rest of it. And of course, got back to Oosterbeek. And there was a house on the corner, and we decided, well, this would be a good place to defend if we're going to form a perimeter, you see. And we started to dig in the grounds around, give us a good view down the road and all this sort of thing.
You had your six-pounder then, did you?
Oh, no, this is now that we don't know what... Whether that was the six-pounder going backwards or not, I should never know. But we never saw that again.
What weapons did you have?
Oh, just our small arms again.
Your rifles?
Rifles. I picked up a Thompson submachine gun up later.
Were you in communication with anyone? Did you have radio?
No, we had no radios at all. Not as a glider pilot unit. Oh. I'm sure there was no. And, of course...
What were your orders on landing? What were you told to do?
In our case, to get to the Artenstein. When we got to the Artenstein, it was fairly well established. So they suggested, well, you go on now into Arnhem and regroup there and see what you can do.
And what was the Artenstein?
That was a large hotel at that time. Mm. It's now a museum. Mm. And that's where Herkart set up his headquarters. Mm. And all the tennis courts around were full of prisoners and all the rest of it. But it seemed that they had enough staff there that... And glider pilots were being involved with that, you see, and the defence of that. And, of course, moved off. And, of course, this is where we all got fragmented, you see. We thought of... because we were coming under mortar fire and so on and so forth. And our Sig said, the funniest thing I ever see was you. He said, you were digging this trench 1 minute. He said, and then the mortar started. And I looked at you and you had your head stuck in the soil that you'd just dug out. And you looked up and opened your eyes and there was this sort of banana skin of shrapnel which was steaming in the wet mud about 3 inches away from your nose. I said, well, what expression did I have on my face? He said, I simply couldn't describe it, he said. Couldn't describe it. So
anyhow, you reached your objective, did you?
We reached what we thought was a good objective in that we got this house and we decided that it would be a good place if the Artenstein, which was about 500 or 600 yards away, and we formed a defensive position along this road, you see. And all that ever came along there was mortar, you see. Over to our right was a 17-pounder battery, just alongside the church. And that, of course, it started off with sort of 10 guns and gradually diminished because it was under fire nearly all the time, you see. And... I'd moved up from this position and taken up a position in another house and with Sigs. The idea was we were going to sort of try and get a clean up, you see.